Yeah, baby.
I like the song too much too. To, you know.
It just reminded me of shagging, man.
Yeah. This is Portugal the Man, Wendy. Not the country, the man. Portugal the Man. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy. Welcome to the show. It's Wednesday. For many of us, it's the middle of the week. We hope you enjoy your middle of the week.
Left the Goofball. That's what you should have your...
That's my band name. That is my band name. Steve Bertrand, is he in the newsroom right now? He's not. When he comes back, he shared a story with me about an encounter he had with the late Barbara Bush that I found very amusing, and I hope he can tell it on the air, because I don't know where he went. He's on break already.
He went to Starbucks.
Did he? I don't want to do it any injustice by retelling it. I would rather have him tell it since he was the one involved. But we did lose former First Lady Barbara Bush. One of the few people... Wait, would it be the only person? The only person who was both married to a president? No?
She wasn't the only one.
Abigail Adams.
Oh, Abigail Adams. I always forget about Abigail Adams.
You know who taught me that? Listen to the Justin Kaufman, The Download,
did
and you learn
that?
Stuff. Not like on our show.
So she was both Abigail Adams and Barbara Bush were both married to a president and had a president as a son. Yeah.
And they had
the same first name, too. John and John Quincy. And George and... George.
Yeah.
Oh.
How about that?
And Barbara and Abigail. Oh, it's not perfect.
That one didn't
almost
work.
Almost close.
That one did not work. Steve, is it okay? Can you tell the story about your encounter with Barbara Bush at the airport? Because I think I love this story.
It's one of my favorite stories. It was way back in the late 80s. George Bush was vice president, and he must have been running for president. So he was coming to DuPage County for a fundraiser. And at the time, DuPage County was a huge... money, big pockets for the Republicans.
Yeah.
And it also was during the time, I think it was the Salt Creek out there that flooded very badly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the Bushes landed, and in those days, you know, the reporters would just go out on the tarmac, and the reporters stood there, and Barbara and George Bush walked up to the scrum, and the president was going to announce a federal disaster in DuPage County for the flooding, so the government would pay for his trip, and then he'd go to a fundraiser.
Yeah.
So he's standing around... and starting to talk, and the TV reporters are there, and everyone's sort of crowding around him. And this reporter from the Daily Herald was running around this side, running around that side. He couldn't get close to them.
Yeah.
And rather than just take notes, he had a little micro recorder, and he wanted to get the every word. So he finally sort of sneaks around to the front. He takes his tape recorder, and he hands it to Barbara Bush. And she has this look on her face like, you know, kind of like she's touching a dead rat at first. Like, what is this?
What do you want me to do with this?
And then you can see.
You have to admire this guy's gutsiness. If you're Barbara Bush, you go, oh, well, all right.
So then she's kind of tickled by it. And so she's holding next to the vice president, holding this tape recorder, recording her husband's words. And then this reporter, I can still see him. I can't remember his name. Was worried it wasn't close enough, so he gets her attention again, and he like motions up, like hold it by his face. And by then she'd had enough, and she just handed it back.
Oh, that's
to
so
him.
Funny.
Yeah,
that's very, very funny.
I liked her.
Yeah, you know, you could certainly disagree with her husband's politics and/or her son's politics,
and I did.
Yeah,
on several occasions.
Yeah.
I was watching Wheel of Fortune last night, and they broke in. But I got my AP alert and everything, knowing that she had passed away, and I know that she had asked not to be left on machines and stuff. She knew this was coming, and she wanted to die on her own.
Well, there were several stories on Monday that they would not be continuing any treatment for her.
Yeah.
And anytime you read that, you say to yourself, well,
it's coming.
That's kind of the beginning of the end, isn't it? Once the doctors huddle and they just go, at this point, we don't think there's anything else we can do. So try to make this as comfortable as possible.
And she was around her family, and, you know, so I guess I knew this was coming.
Yeah.
But just the little retrospective they had on her was very touching, and I didn't feel like I was that close to her before her death, but after watching some of this best of moments of her life, she really seemed like a pretty wonderful woman.
Are you of the same mindset I am? Anytime you hear about anybody who has lost a child, as she and her husband did, their daughter was, I think, 3 and a half when she died years and years ago. There's a special kind of sympathy for them because it's just the worst thing anyone can go through. I can't imagine anything worse than that.
I had read reports that she had been referring to her 3-year-old daughter she lost. Was it Dorothy? I can't remember her name.
Yes,
Robin.
Dorothy, I believe.
Robin.
That's Robin.
She was referring to her in her final hours like she was going to go meet with her child. And it's like there was an interview where she just said, you never forget that.
They've unearthed a letter that her husband, George H.W. Bush, wrote to her all the way back in 1943. And it's so unlike, like, you have in your head what he was probably like and is probably like. And then you read this letter, and again, it's from 1943, so he would have been a very, very young man when he wrote this, I think 18 or 19. Let's take a little break, and then I'll read you part of the letter, because it's extremely touching and poignant.
This is to her?
Yeah.
They met when they were six.
Letter.
She was 16.
Yeah, at a dance.
My God.
A long, long time ago. all right, so let's take a quick break, and then I'll read you a little portion of this letter that really makes you rethink George H.W. Bush. He seemed a lot grittier than this letter would imply, you know? All right, so that's coming up in just a little bit, and then more shows. Stay here. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder. As you probably are already aware, we lost a former First Lady yesterday. Barbara Bush passed away. So I found this letter, this love letter, that had been written by her husband, George H.W. Bush. They met, as we said, when they were just teenagers. She was 17. He was 18. They met at a Christmas dance. He said, and boy, is this romantic. He wrote this in his autobiography. I'm not much at recalling what people wear, but that particular occasion stands out in my memory. He talked about how the band was playing Glenn Miller tunes, and he had asked a friend from New York who that girl was across the room. She was wearing a green and red holiday dress, and it just kind of stayed in his head, which I give
really
big
sweet.
Points for, you know. So he wrote this letter. He went back and served more military time after they had gotten married. So here's what he wrote. He said, I love you, precious. Oh, it starts out, my darling Bar. I love you, precious, with all my heart, and to know that you love me means my life. How often I have thought about the immeasurable joy that will be ours someday and how lucky our children will be to have a mother like you. That's just beautiful.
That's pretty sweet. She seemed like such a fun, loving woman.
Yeah.
And I know people made fun of her a lot.
There was that. Yeah, you got a little bit of that, yeah.
But just watching all the stuff, I was shocked to see that she was pro-choice.
Isn't that surprising?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
well,
she said,
she bucked them on a couple things. She also on some on gun issues. She kind of spoke. I mean, she was known for speaking her mind in support of her family, but also sometimes when she didn't quite agree with them.
We, you know, oftentimes my wife and I, and sometimes our kids, vacation in Maine. There's a town called Ogunquit that we vacation in. And about 20 minutes away is Kennebunkport, where the Bush compound is, where they spend a lot of time. And it's immense. It's gigantic. And my wife has told the story. I've never been with her when this has happened. But when you run there, my wife's a runner, so most mornings she gets up early and takes a jog, a mile or two jog. And she said, because the Bush compound is so close by, there's cameras in the trees everywhere you run. And while you're running, you hear...
Oh, where it's moving?
It's the cameras moving to follow you.
Wow, that's freaky.
And they do a weird thing in Kennebunkport. They don't do it so much now, but they did this when George Bush was the president. Not George H.W., but George W. Bush. Is when you go shopping in and around Kennebunkport... They go out of their way to tell you that you just missed the Bushes. They were in, you just missed them. They were in 5 minutes ago. You know, stick around. Sometimes they come in and they walk around town and then they come back in. You could meet them. They'll be here in any minute. Just stay close.
And is the first it true?
Year, well, no, it's not true.
I'd fall for anything.
Was it the second year? The second year they did that, because we walked around going, boy, the same thing happened last year when we were here. That's so odd. And then several shops did that. And then we saw in the news that at that point they were in Veracruz that week, that the Bush family was nowhere near their house or compound, that they were way, you know, far away. But that's like a thing they do to get you excited.
Well, it would be exciting. Houston, of course, mourning Barbara Bush, as it says in the New York Times. I love this headline. Houston mourns Barbara Bush, its revered matriarch and salty neighbor.
Now, because you read that to me earlier, and I'm trying to figure out if you're her, Would you look upon that as a compliment?
Absolutely.
I think you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, she was no pushover.
Right. As we just illustrated with the fact that she kind of, you know, there were certain policies that the party or the family was on one side of, and she would take the opposite side. So good for her.
And she wore her trademark pearls, much like Marge Simpson.
Yeah, right, right.
Susie wants to talk about the late, great Barbara Bush. Hi, Susie. How are you?
Hi. Okay, how are you? Interesting. Years ago, when my kids were at overnight camp in Maine, Freiburg, Maine, we stopped at Kenny Bunkport for like two nights. And what I noticed about that town, yes, with the running, Bill, you know, that my husband at the time was a runner,
mm-hmm.
and they had, you know, the cameras, and you could run up that bridge, I think, but they had all the lobster traps in the water.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that I knew that they, not when George H. Bush was in town, but when Barbara Bush was in town, they would put up a flag to let everybody know because they loved her so much.
Oh, cool.
Loved knowing when she was there. And then I did hear this, I think, on Anderson Cooper, that she called Bill Clinton her fifth son.
Really?
Yes, yes.
Well, he and George H.W. Bush, in recent years, there's been this interesting alliance.
Well, because when they get together for things, there aren't that many living presidents left, so they have hooked up, and it does seem like they're, I don't know if they're hanging out.
I mean, she didn't call Jimmy Carter her fifth son,
right?
But she called Bill Clinton her fifth son.
What do you think? I think they united in aid for Haiti.
Is that what it was,
Steve? Haitian earthquake?
Yeah.
It could have been. I don't know the reason, but I just know that that was what I heard about her. But she was quite the woman from what, and I have, my daughter-in-law's parents live in Texas, and I know that she's revered from them.
Yeah.
So she was quite the woman.
I think so. Well, thank you, Susie. We appreciate the call. Have a great day.
You too.
Take care.
She was seen walking her dogs. She had two Maltipoos, Maltese and Poodles, and their names were BB and Mini-Me.
A huge fan of the Austin Powers movies. Gigantic fan of the Austin Powers movies. I was telling Steve this earlier today. Last night I was watching Anderson Cooper's show, and he ran some clips of an interview that Larry King had done with Barbara and with her husband, George H.W. Bush. And he asked that question that, I don't know, I guess this was a good question to ask, but he said something along the lines of, are some members of your family more favorited than others? Do you have some kids that you like more than others? Which is a weird question, but I, you know, why not? Because there were...
You ask me that all the time.
I always ask you that, but you're not the president or the first lady. But both Barbara and George H.W. Bush went out of their way to let Larry know that even though some of them have had higher positions, for instance, being the president of the United States, no, absolutely not. They love each of their children equally. They just, like, both of them are like, no. They just, you know, Larry, please, we love all the kids equally. And then Barbara pointed out that she believes that's the reason they're all so close, is that no one was given any special treatment.
Well, Joe Scarborough, who's the host of Morning Joe, former Republican congressman, a conservative, and tied into the political circles, I don't see an attribution here, but he just tweeted out a quote from her from last week, apparently, and it's on his Facebook page as well. Barbara Bush to her doctor last week, joking in front of her son. And the quote is, "Do you want to know why George W. is the way he is? Because I drank and smoked while I was pregnant."
Oh, my God. She's so funny. And, you know, talking about her dogs, Bill, there's a reason she named one Mini-Me. It looks just like her.
Yeah, the dog has a very similar look.
So tell me she doesn't have a sense of humor?
Yeah, that's...
BB and Mini-Me.
That's very funny. But, no, this is interesting. And, again, I don't remember who did this interview with them. I want to say it was Barbara Walters, and it wasn't that long ago, where they asked the question. There were always hums that the Bush family believed that Jeb would be the president, not George. And that was the question that was posed to them, and they didn't pull any punches. They went, yeah, we were sure if we had a kid that was the president, it would have been Jeb, not George. Nope.
I remember hearing that, too. I don't know where
that's hysterical.
And finally, Annette wanted to mention something. Hi, Annette.
Hi, Hed. How are you doing, Wendy?
Good.
How's your knees? How's your knees? I keep thinking about you.
Knee is doing great. It really is.
I, I've had a hip, and that's good too. Good to go. It's great to know they have that.
Excellent.
I just wanted to let you know that I had the pleasure of listening to Barbara speak. Oh golly, at least 15 years ago, and granted, she did kind of look like George's mom because of that yeah. crazy wife here.
Yeah.
She was the most exceptional woman. She addressed a group of women. And, of course, spoke about her family issues and how she was so concerned about reading and education of children. And our organization, the General Federation of Women's Clubs in Illinois, this was our state organizational meeting, and it was exceptional. And I've loved that lady from the day I heard her speak.
Oh, she was that's perfect.
Exceptional. Just
excellent.
Exceptional.
Well, thank you for sharing that, and glad you got to experience that. Take care of that hip of yours. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Annette.
You guys were like the fishermen in Jaws that are all showing the different parts where the sharks had bit you.
I'll show her my tattoo later.
All right. We'll take a quick break. Steve has the news. We'll talk about the World's Fair in just a little bit. Dr. John Duffy is going to join us. It's a full show, so stay here. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
You don't mind that I wore my flapper dress today, Bill.
No, it looks good on you. A lot of people can't pull those off, Wendy, but boy, you look
all
great.
All people have pulled it off.
Yeah, I bet. I can imagine.
We are going to talk about the 24th annual World's Fair Memorabilia Show. It's happening this Sunday, and the World's Fair historian, really the only one we know, Rick Rann, is in the studio. Rick, how are you?
Hey, Bill and Wendy, how you doing?
To Wendy's point, does anyone know more on the planet about the World's Fair than you? I don't think so.
There probably are, but...
Are there really?
Yeah, wow. There's a lot of people interested in it. Yeah. It really affected a lot of people in the Chicago area. 39 million people went to it over 2 years.
Wow.
That's unbelievable. I didn't know we had that many people back then.
Yeah, well, they came from all over the world to come to the World's Fair.
It was that big of a destination, right?
It was a big destination.
Yeah.
All right, brief history of it. 1933 was when it happened.
Right.
And what was the reason for it? Just to put Chicago on the map? What started it?
Well, they usually have World's Fair every 4 years, and they're approved by the International Consortium of World's Fair, I don't know the exact organization name, but they approve them. And they had them in 1904 in St. Louis, 1893 in Chicago, the Columbian Exposition for the 400th anniversary, a year late, of the founding of Columbus, 1492 to 1892, but they didn't get around to doing it until 1893. They had them every 4 years all over the world. So they decided to have it in Chicago, and they called it a Century of Progress, referring to the founding of Chicago in 1833, the 100 years to 1933.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me, when I see pictures, you bring in these fascinating pictures. It reminds me of that place of progress in Disney, kind of.
At Epcot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just what I would equate it with. Disney did come to some World's Fairs, and that's what it is. It's like a permanent exhibition.
So it's kind of a tip of the hat to the past, but it's also a, hey, if you think things are good now, wait till you see what's coming down the pike, right?
Right.
They want to showcase what the future holds for
us. Previous World Fairs a lot of times would have like gold medals for the best pickles or whatever, you know. But this fair was a big corporate event because a lot of companies had working factories. Chevrolet had a working factory at the fair. You could stand on the second floor and look down in the General Motors building and see Chevrolet cars being assembled on an assembly line. They would roll off and they'd have a special plaque on the windshield saying assembled at the Chicago World's Fair.
How about that?
And then they also had paintings all around the second floor of the General Motors building, which showed murals from each state showing which products were made in that state to make into cars, and those murals after the World's Fair were given to Lane Tech High School here in Chicago, and they're still all over Lane Tech, and
very
you can
nice.
Go in and see them if you call up.
Very nice.
That is so cool.
And a lot of times, things that are commonplace to us now are first introduced, like the Ferris wheel, right? Nobody had seen a Ferris wheel until
right.
the World's Fair.
I mean, and this Ferris wheel in 1893 at the Columbian Exposition is enormous. I mean, each car held, I believe, 80 people.
Yeah. Oh,
80 people. I mean, it was... I believe, a couple hundred feet high. I mean, it wasn't just like the Ferris wheel. See, I mean, the Ferris wheel they built out here now is larger, but this thing was enormous, 80 people. I mean, it's just amazing.
I can't even imagine that. You brought pictures, which people will be able to see, and we'll talk about where the memorabilia show is going to be held, Elk Grove Holiday Inn. We'll give you all the information. But you brought some photographs and or some drawings, some sketches of what was going on, and you mentioned something that keeps sticking in my mind. It was just temporary building.
Yeah, this fair was done with all private resources. There was no public funds involved. A lot of times you hear now, oh, we're going to have the World's Fair here, and they were planning, I think Byrne was going to try to have a World's Fair here in 1992,
yeah.
But that kind of fell through. But, you know, we thought, well, geez, how much money would have been wasted on that, public funds? This was all done through private funding, so...
Corporate sponsorships,
yeah.
That sort of thing.
They sold exhibit space,
yeah.
But also they had people in 1927 sign up. They would give $1,000 to become founder members, like the McCormicks,
yeah.
The Insulls.
Yeah.
They would give $1,000 to get seed money. Then they also got just regular people to pay $5 to join the World's Fair Legion. And for that $5 they gave in 1928, they would get a book of 10 admissions.
Oh.
And they signed up about 128,000 people for that. So that raised $600,000. And then another way they did it is they got some bigwigs. The person running the fair was Rufus Dawes, and his brother was former Vice President Charles Cutler Dawes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to raise funds through guaranteed notes where they would get all these people to loan the money to the World's Fair, and they would be paid out of gate receipts.
Oh.
And at the end of the World's Fair, after the second year of the World's Fair, they ended up paying everyone back and actually having a profit,
a
which they
profit.
Donated to local institutions. Another way they raised funds is this was during the Depression when they started building it. Companies would be paid in scrip. The companies would say, sure, we'll get our people working.
Yeah.
And you'll be paid out of the gate receipts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I mentioned, you know, this stuff was just temporary. It kills me to think that those buildings were torn down. And I said, isn't that a waste? But you said, not really.
Well, when you see how amazing Art Deco these buildings looked, you think, wow, it's a shame these didn't stay after the World's Fair. They wouldn't have lasted. They were just meant to be a temporary buildings for 6 months, because that way they could build them cheaper and not have to put as much money into building them.
But was there a safety concern that went along with that?
And that makes me think of the Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that Ferris wheel, they never had any problems in 1893. They didn't have any safety problems, but they did have to touch up after 6 months. It was supposed to end in November of 1933. Near the end of the fair, they decided they still owed money in the bonds, and it was still doing very well, so they decided to hold it over for another year.
Oh.
None of the buildings had heat. That was another way to make them cheap, except for the administration building. So I remember talking to people who actually worked there and said they froze, because it was right on the lakefront between Roosevelt and Pershing,
yeah.
Including Northern Isles. So they were freezing, because you know how it is in April,
yeah,
May, June, July.
Especially
right.
Now.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. It could have snow on the ground.
You know, when we see the pictures of these buildings, to us they look very old and retro, but for the time they were almost
modern.
Futuristic.
Most of them were very futuristic. Frank Lloyd Wright wrote a scathing review of them. He didn't like the buildings. But this wasn't going to be the White City. Like 1893 was classical architecture.
Yeah.
They called it the White City. Everything was painted white, marble. This was more like a rainbow. They had a palette of Joseph Urban. A set designer had a palette of about 22 colors, which all the buildings had to use. So
They were required to use a combination of those.
But yeah. It was the first large use of like gypsum or wallboard, and they painted them in these wonderful paints, pinks, greens. The Travel and Transportation Building, this enormous building under a breathing dome, was painted in light green. Yellows,
yeah.
Cobalt blues, just amazing colors. Most of the pictures you see are black and white, but when you see color pictures, you go, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
What was Frank Lloyd Wright's beef? Just too flashy? Is that what he was
saying? He didn't like the way it looked.
The lines were not good for him, I would imagine.
He likes more boxy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't think this was true architecture.
Boy, he would have hated the Lucas Museum if it ever came here. And probably Soldier Field, what they did to
it.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
The toilet bowl in there.
It's the 24th annual World's Fair memorabilia show. It takes place on Sunday at the Elk Grove Holiday Inn. We'll give you more information in just a little bit. Rick Rand is our guest. If you have any questions or comments, we're easy to reach. We're 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Say, Billy, would you like to go to the World's Fair with me?
Absolutely.
It's the 24th annual World's Fair Memorabilia Show. It's happening Sunday, this Sunday, April 22nd. Hours are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And it's going to be at the Elk Grove Holiday Inn, 1000 Bussey Road. That's Route 83 and Landmeyer Road in Elk Grove Village. And our show's World Fair historian, Rick Rand, is in the studio. You can go to World's Fair Show, right? WorldsFairShow.com?
Yeah, all one word.
Okay. So again, he's showing us some pictures, which you have to go to the show to see, but you're explaining how the buildings were very colorful, and you're right, we just see them in black and white. I didn't know for a minute that they were so colorful. And then at night, like, just such a light show.
At night they would have a lighting ceremony where one by one the buildings would be lit up. A spotlight would come from the Hall of Science, which captured light from the star Arcturus, which was 40 light years away. So the light that started when the 1893 World's Fair was going on started the lights at the World's Fair. And one by one, they would switch, flip a photoelectric switch, and then the spotlight would hit the travel and transport, and that would light up. And they, one by one, they would light them up each night. And also they had... this was probably the largest use of neon tubing because the patent had just expired, so they were allowed to use it for a cheap price. So they all the buildings had neon tubing and gaseous tubing of reds, greens, yellows, just amazing.
And you mentioned, because we couldn't quite figure out what this picture was, and again, you can see these pictures. We should take a picture of this to put on our Facebook page to show you. But you mentioned in the photo... Northerly Island was shown, and I heard you say to Bill that they added landfill to make it bigger. I don't know any of this
stuff.
Yeah,
they added about 40% more landfill to increase the size of Northerly Island.
And that, for the fair itself?
For the fair, yeah. It was on the west side of Northerly Island and included the lagoon and then Northerly Island. All the buildings went. You could walk. It was probably 2 miles long. And then they had the Sky Ride, which was like the Ferris wheel, and that went from Northern Island to the other part of the fair.
It's so strange to see an area that you're accustomed to seeing, but with an alternate reality.
Oh, you know? Exactly, yeah.
Can we take a couple of phone calls?
Sure.
Janet's on the line, 312-981-7200. Hi, Janet. Rick Rand is here. Big show for the annual World's Fair Memorabilia Show this Sunday.
Hi, Bill and Wendy and Rick. Bill and Wendy, I always listen to your show, my favorite.
Oh, you're so kind.
Jana.
Thanks.
I have about 40 black and white tiny little pictures, about 2 by 3 inches, of all the lots and lots of buildings and rides from the 1933 World Fair. And I have color postcards. I was wondering, my dad took it, and I was wondering, is there any value to these photos and postcards?
Are the photos ones he took himself, or are they like souvenir ones that they sold?
Not 100% sure, but I think he took them himself.
Why are they so tiny?
Oh, they had a 2-inch by 2-inch up to a larger size. I have probably 5 or 10,000 snapshots that I've bought from collections over the years.
But they're more valuable if Janet's father took them, right?
Yeah, because then it's a rare. You might have that one-of-a-kind shot.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, you know, the one-of-a-kind shot which someone, you know, might capture that one moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he took them because they're not all centered beautifully.
Yeah, I mean, if they're blurry, they're people kind of walking to the side, then yeah, he probably took them. And souvenir ones usually will have printed on the front of them, you know, the Travel and Transport Building, Chicago World's Fair, 1933. So they probably are ones he took.
What do you think they might be worth? Ballpark. I mean, I guess it's hard to tell.
Snapshots from $1 to $10. I mean, you know, if it's a great shot of, say, the House of Marbles. House of Marbles
Did
collection.
You live there,
What's
Bill?
The House of Marbles?
House of Marbles.
I went in.
Was the Master Marble Company had glass walls filled with marbles, so it looked like a House of Marbles. And on top, it had a huge globe shaped like a marble.
How and cool is
the Mets,
this?
Their marble company sold packets of marbles there. Only in 1933. They left in 34. They couldn't afford it, I guess.
They lost their marbles.
They lost their marbles. But those little sets of marbles in the original boxes from the World's Fair go for $100, $200, $300, $400 for the marbles. That's one of the most expensive things.
Look for those, Janet. Maybe you'll find some of those in your house. And what if Janet can't make it? I don't know if you can go to the show at Elk Grove Holiday Inn on Sunday. What should she do if she can't make
it? She can email me pictures of some of the photos if she goes to the website.
All right. The website is worldsfairshow.com, all one word. Thank you so much
for
calling.
Thanks, Janet.
Thank you.
And Sarah wants to talk to us as well. Hi, Sarah.
Yeah, hi guys. My father in 1933 was 16 years old. We're talking from a staunch Irish Catholic family. He got a job working at the Orange Julius stand. He snuck away from work to go watch Sally Rand, the fan dancer.
How scandalous. He was never the same. You never saw him again.
Wait, Orange Julius?
They had a House of Marbles and an Orange Julius?
Orange. Yeah. I know they had orange. I didn't know Orange Julius, but they did have orange there. Yeah, they did have all kinds. They had hundreds of restaurants and booths.
Why don't we ever recreate this? Why doesn't this happen again? Taste of Chicago is a sorry excuse for this.
This was huge.
Sarah, thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome.
I just sounded like Sarah Palin there. Thanks for calling.
For people who don't know of Sally Rand, she would do
She would do the fan dance, supposedly naked, but probably wearing a bodysuit, like nylon or something. And she would flip the fans so that that darn fan would just get in the way, so you couldn't see what you wanted to see.
Yeah.
And every so now and then, they would get busted, and they would drag her into court. And I remember one judge said something like, "These are just a bunch of boobs. Get out of here." Something like that.
And she did this later in her life.
Oh, she did it into the 50s, into the 60s, like at places and displays. Because you'll see the cards showing her from 33, and a lot of times they're autographed because she'd go out and autograph photos for people.
What was her name?
Sally Rand.
Rand with a D.
Rand. I looked up Sally Ride. I'm like, you guys are messing this up.
She did not do that.
Rand. She put the Rand in there.
And Randy.
Yes. All right. So what can we expect to see over in Elk Grove Village? This, again, is the 24th annual World's Fair memorabilia show. We have Rick Rand on almost every year since I've been here. Elk Grove Holiday Inn, 1000 Bussey Road, Route 83 and Landmeyer Road. It's happening this Sunday. What else? What is some of the special things we might see if we go?
We show one and a half hours of newsreels and home movies from the World's Fair of 33 on video. There's a display of 1933 fair memorabilia and photos, including an architectural model of the Sears building, which I was going to bring down, but it was like 3 feet long.
Oh,
I thought,
that's okay.
I can't really get it in here. There'll also be 20 tables of items, dealers and collectors selling thousands of items from the 1933 Chicago World's Fair, and also items from the 1893 Columbian Exposition, along with items from other World's Fair. You can bring down your items to see what they're worth, and there's just thousands. It's just amazing. Everything from little snapshots to postcards, thousands of postcards, over the years, we've had a rickshaw cart that someone brought down from the World's Fair, uniforms from the World's Fair.
That's excellent. There's a caller who has a question. We don't have time to get to it, but I'm just going to give you a brief version. They want to know if Devil in the White City brought a renewed interest to the World's Fair. It had to.
Huge.
Us.
And before then, the 1893 common tickets, which they had after the World's Fair, would sell for $10 to $15. The Devil in the White City is such a fantastic book. It brought so many young people into it. The average age before the collector seemed to be 60, 70, 80 for 1893. Now you have, 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 25-year-olds, kids coming to collect 1893 stuff because it was such an interesting time and it was such a great book. So the tickets now that used to be real common, they're still fairly common, but they're going for $20, $30, $40, $50, $75, $100. It's amazing.
I'm just watching video on YouTube of Sally Rand, and I want to get some fans like that. They're all feathery and beautiful.
You have to get
That's pretty amazing.
Can Wendy perform at the convention?
I'll have to work on it for next year.
if she practices.
You're going to sell a lot of tickets.
Rick, it is a pleasure, and thank you. You always bring something very unique for us. The WLS Music Radio 89, this wasn't the Silver Dollar Survey. What is this? grab the coin from my hand, Grasshopper.
Yes,
I feel it's very Kung Fu-esque.
It sure is, isn't it? It really is. Dr. John Duffy, one of our favorite guests, joins us. He comes by every other Wednesday, and we talk about the mind, the brain. There's a definite main topic to get to, John, but first, Wendy and I, like once or twice a week, we have something that we go, hey, we have to run that past Dr. Duffy, because he'll know the answer to this. So the other day during the bonus hour, and I don't remember exactly how it came up, but we were talking about repressed memories, that certain events in our life, it's easier for us.
Oh, because I don't remember things. My dad died when I was 10, and I don't remember anything.
Right, right.
Yeah. So explain how that works, because I'm positive that that's a real thing. That's not imagined. But what is the brain doing there where it's repressing memories?
So because, if I may just say, Bill said, you were 10. You should have more childhood memories than I do. I don't really remember anything.
Right, right. Well, most of us remember before the age of 10 or 11.
10 weeks in Bill's case.
I remember a bunch of stuff from when I was less than, I was not even 2 years old yet.
That is so unusual.
Yeah.
Are they traumatic memories?
No, but real mundane, everyday things.
You're a nostalgic guy. I can imagine even at 24 months, you might have been thinking like, I better hang on to this.
Yes,
you know, Mr. Ed is not going to be on forever. I'm going to pay attention here.
All right, the example I said to Wendy is, my brother was born when I was almost 2.5, not quite 2.5, but I can tell you everything that happened from the time I woke up until the time I went to bed that day, like
right?
It was yesterday.
Yeah. Okay, so oddly enough, my brother was born when I was 2.5, too.
Yeah.
And I remember it vividly. Before he passed away, I ran that memory by my dad.
Yeah.
And he said, none of that happened. You've got
really?
It wrong.
See?
Yes.
That's what I was telling you. Because I got run over by Ronnie Doovy, and I said, my sister or my family told me about it. So in my head, I'm like, oh, I totally remember when that happened.
Sure.
But you're not remembering it from your experience. It's from your vision of it or something.
Right, right, right. Which, you know, sometimes they're more accurate than others. Some kids do get remarkable memories early in life. But the repressed memory often comes from something that is traumatic. And it's this way of the brain is amazing, because the mind can compartmentalize something that's like, okay, I'm too young. I can't integrate this into my psyche. I'm going to park it somewhere in the back of my mind, and I'll bring it back up when I'm ready to deal with it. So I don't know when you were talking about repressed memories, if somewhere along the line in adulthood they came back. But if you said they did, I wouldn't be surprised. If they didn't, they may, or they may be unnecessary.
So if it's a defense mechanism, is that blocking?
Exactly.
So with Wendy, let's say she was 10 when her dad died. Mm-hmm. Is that a way of saying it's almost like coding yourself so you almost won't miss him as much?
Yeah.
Is that
your way of protecting yourself,
right? Right, from a really traumatic loss, right? Because the 10-year-old mind really doesn't know how to integrate the loss of a parent. I mean, you know, so we kind of put that somewhere else in our mind, and, you know, and we either deal with it at a later date or we don't. Sometimes we do it as adults too. My father died and I was in my 30s and I was in denial for a month or two, you know, kind of not really, it was all but repressed. I knew it was there.
Yeah.
I was well aware of it.
Yeah.
But it took me a long time to the point where I was ready to actually deal with it and have that cry, you know?
I purposely don't remember the date in which my mom died, because when I was a kid, the date that her mother died was the worst day of the year for her. All day long, she'd go, this is the day your grandmother died. She didn't want to go out. She didn't want to do anything.
Right.
So my brain has tricked myself into not, I know the month and that's all I know. I purposely don't know the day that she
and
died.
And if somebody approached you with that day, you'd say, no, don't tell me.
No, I
right,
don't want
see,
it.
See, that's your defense mechanism.
Yeah,
that's
is.
A really
it
potent defense,
is.
Right? I don't want that anniversary to show up in my psyche, and I don't want that day ruined. I don't want to be having sad memories about my mother. Yeah,
right.
No, that makes a lot of sense. No, the brain, the mind is really deft at protecting itself, especially the young mind. I'm always impressed with the childhood mind that is traumatized and still manages to find a reasonably healthy way past it by effectively ignoring it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't understand how that happens. I know I watch a lot of TV and I can't tell what's real and what isn't, but there was some young kid who just had a mom, didn't have a dad, and the mom was a meth head and was pretty much high all the time. And this young kid probably 8 to 10 years old was handling things in the house. Now, again, I don't remember if this was fact or fiction,
right?
But it does happen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but imagine the alternative. I always think about it this way. Like, if you think about the alternative, I'm 8 years old and I have to think about the fact that my mother is taking drugs. I'm alone in the world. I've got to figure this out on my own and navigate the world on my own. It is a lot healthier to kind of put that, park that somewhere in the back burner of your mind and just go along your life as if you're eight. You know,
there's
something really, really adaptive about that.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Dr. John Duffy's here. We'll talk more next. Stay here. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
I just thought it was something new that I had
coast
not heard
gutter.
Of.
You got a coast that needs gutting? That's your, the Mackinac is the one to go to.
Dr. John Duffy is with us, clinical psychologist, host of a podcast called Better that he hosts, co-hosts with his wife, Julie Duffy. The Available Parent is a great book to read, and you can find him, drjohnduffy.com. Did we want to talk about something specifically today?
One thing I thought that seems so elemental, but I find that people ignore it far too often, is having kids involved in something extracurricular.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school and even in middle school, there was a little romance to being like a lone wolf. I'm not going to be a joiner. I'm not going to sign up for things. Now I think it's so imperative for kids to be involved in something outside of the classroom. Julie and I, I'm Better, recently interviewed my son's former swim coach. His name's Scott Walker. Shout out to Scott. And he called the pool a sanctuary where there were no phones. There were no parents talking to the kids. There was no social media. There was no social drama. And there was no classroom drama. And for those couple of hours every single day, all they were focused on is like the backstroke, you know? And I think for kids who are involved in a sport or a play or a group or a club, those few hours of sanctuary are so important right now.
Right.
And we kind of ignore that. And I've worked with too many parents who've said, well, school's so important. I think school can be my kid's thing, but I think our kids need a break from that. And they need something
fun.
Else. They need fun. Yes, they need to be able to play, and kids don't play anymore, right? They're looking down or they're working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned swimming, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a sports team. That's fine, but
yeah.
It can be music. It can be Dungeons and Dragons.
It can be a play. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
The radio station at the school, the television station.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, you know, a lot of the things that our kids have been involved in, and just about anything that takes your mind into a different space, because there's so many things that happen there. There's this mentorship that happens, right? Because we can't always get our kids to where they reach their potential. Julie and I, in particular, we never wanted our son George to be uncomfortable.
Right.
And so we never would have said, you're going to get up at 5 in the morning and get in a swimming pool.
Yeah.
I think we would have said, no, you rest. Everything's
right,
fine. You know?
Right.
And meanwhile, there's a coach saying, no, you're going to get in the pool. It's going to be cold. You're going to be miserable. You're going to be mad at me. And somehow there's this grit. You learn something about yourself, then your resilience by doing something, by being in the play that's rehearsing until 10 o'clock at night and you still have homework to do.
Yeah.
And you realize, I can make it through that. I can do that. And I don't know a different way to learn that than by doing things. Being, you know, okay, I got to host a radio show after school and then I got to go do homework and I got to figure all this stuff out,
yeah.
You know?
Well, there's also the aspect of interaction and being around people of a like mind. There's something you have in common with other people.
You feel like you belong.
Yeah.
Right. There's that teamwork elements too, right? You know, like Jasmine and I were talking a little bit about your cheerleading work, right? And that, you know, you're part of this team that's got this common goal, right? So you've got to work together. You got to cooperate. And if you think about it, that's a skill you guys are using today, you know, like we use for a lifetime.
Jasmine keeps saying to Wendy and I, we want to get you guys and your guests in the shape of a pyramid at the end of every show. And I'm uncomfortable with that.
You are.
Yeah.
I do want to say, having two boys that are not athletes, and Bill, you mentioned this too, it doesn't have to be sports. I'm noticing that with my kids, the freshman year in high school is where it starts slowly. Like, there's one thing that kind of catches their interest, and when that one thing happens, then it starts branching out with, oh, well, now I'm going to try this. It's that one thing that you have to find that will open the door for you to branch out into other things.
I love the one thing, Wendy, you know, because there's a win in the one thing. It's like, oh, I like this thing. I think I'm good at this thing. It might not be the perfect thing, so I'll go over here and I'll try this out. And then after some period of time, you get this adult, right, who's in charge of the thing, who looks your kid in the eye and says, you're really good at this. Or, you know, you're good at this. You have all sorts of potential. I know you can do better. And that is a big thing for a kid to hear, and they may never hear it in the classroom,
especially
if they underperform in a classroom.
I know this is a sidebar to this, but it's an important sidebar to it. What do you do when your kid says, I've been doing this for 3 weeks, and I got to be honest, I don't think this is for me. Do you make them stick with it, or how do you handle that?
My personal bias on this, I play the parent card here. I don't play it everywhere. I reserve it, like if it's another half hour of Fortnite or Instagram, I'm willing to throw in the towel on that.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of sticking something out, in part because you learn you can do that. Like, I don't really love this thing. It's not the right thing, but I made it through it. I don't love the coach or the director or whatever, but I made it. I succeeded in making it through the season. Now I'll go
through the whole season?
Through the whole season.
If my mom didn't let me quit gymnastics after 3 weeks, I would have killed myself. And I'm not even being funny. I was terrible at it. It was embarrassing. And then I found basketball and loved that more.
Well, okay, so if you find something else you love more, I love the substitute. I can live with, like I'm going to shapeshift and do this thing, but to just opt out, that I think is not a healthy thing for kids.
Because then a kid gets used to that, and all through their life, they go, well, if I don't like something, I can just quit.
Yep, I can just quit, and there's no opportunity anywhere to build my self-esteem, my self-worth.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Jazzy, I don't know how you do gymnastics, because I swear to God, that was the worst thing in my life.
It's not that scary. Once you get over the fear, it's fine.
Yeah, no.
You never got over the fear.
No, and I just took this. It was a Riverside Recreation class, and all my friends were really good at it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Mom, I know you spent a lot of money here, but I cannot do it. I can't. Right. It was like I was looking foolish.
Oh, no one wants that.
No, right.
No one wants that.
I worked with a boy not long ago who felt going into high school like he was weak. He joined the gymnastics team. And Jasmine, maybe you can support this. Within a couple of weeks, he felt like, I am mighty as can be. Like, his hands were torn to shreds. But he did the Iron Cross for like 3 seconds, and
holy
he thought,
moly.
Oh my gosh, I'm the Hulk, you know?
Wow. I can attest to that.
Yeah?
I can definitely attest to that. I got my first rip when I was doing gymnastics. I see, 10 years old. I've been doing it since I was like 5.
What's a rip?
I walked around showing my hands.
So you tear the skin on your hand? Is that what it does?
Right, Jasmine?
Why would anybody do that?
Wow. Yeah, the bar and the grip is really hard, so you have to have chalk, and you have to chalk up. That's why you see like all the athletes right before they get on the bars and beams to do it.
Yeah.
And wrapping, right? You wrap your hands. But these people, like Jasmine would play injured, like really injured in the only spot where she's making contact with the apparatus and still going through and doing it.
So the bottom line is find something extracurricular. Don't just.
And gymnasts are badass. That's what we're learning today.
This is a fact.
Absolutely. So true. That's Dr. John Duffy. He's our favorite psychologist. He's the show's psychologist is what he is. Certified life coach, parenting and relationship expert. And again, Better can be heard on WGN Plus. People want to hear that.
Absolutely.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, guys.
News is next. Stay here. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Kim Gordon, thank you so much. Kim, you should come downstairs because
heaven has visited us.
I got to tell you, WGN Radio picks up the Chicago White Sox, and then all of a sudden White Castle is on board, and they brought a couple of Crave cases, and there is nothing like a White Castle. You've been eating them since you've been a little kid.
Nothing like a slider.
Well, they asked us. They said, have you either of you ever tried a White Castle? And then we both went, tried them? Oh, man.
I don't like kids like you. You were special. You still are.
Well, thank you, Wendy. I know that that's a compliment in a strange way. In my grade school, as most kids brought, salami or ham and cheese or bologna, we would go to the White Castle that was near us, and we would load up, and then every day in my lunch, I had 2 White Castle hamburgers.
Every day?
Almost every day, more days than not. And
Your mom was a saint.
The kids got very jealous. Yeah, she was. There she was. And they gave me a special permission to go into the teacher's lounge. This is in the early days of microwave ovens, radar ranges, as they were called at the time. And I was allowed to go into the teacher's lounge, something very few kids ever were able to do, and heat up my lunch every day.
Which then everything smelled like White Castle, so when you smell them, you want them.
Yeah, I know.
There's nothing like the onions.
Oh, so good.
They're so steamed, good. And they're delicious.
Did you ever just watch? They have that little plexiglass window while they're cooking them, and you can just stand there and watch them being prepared.
Of course I
and
do.
That's art for me. I think that's high art.
One of my old boyfriends on Valentine's Day, you know what? I don't even think it was on Valentine's Day. It was just a date. We actually went inside and had it, and I was impressed because it came on a paper plate.
Oh.
It was like, yeah, oh my God, look, they're not in boxes.
No.
They were just...
They serve them up.
Yeah.
Yep. So we're doing them a huge favor by eating these White Castles and enjoying them.
I just want to know
for everybody
how many people right now listening are going to stop and get a Crave case on their way home. And if I can steal an idea from my friend Brad Crawford.
What does Brad Crawford do?
Whenever we have neighborhood parties, and Kim, you know this, you have a dip. I like to make a BLT dip sometimes. People bring things.
Yeah.
Brad brings a Crave case from White Castle, and oh my God, everybody loves him.
He's a smart man.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Yep.
I'm stealing it.
All right.
And I heard now that if you're really healthy and still want to go to White Castle, they have veggie burgers
They do.
Now.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
There are some here, Kim, if that's your objective. They brought some.
I would like to meet the one person who tries a veggie burger.
Do they still have little holes in them?
Well, they have to cook quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why they did it.
Once the product is finished, there's no discernible holes, but
right.
When you've first seen it thrown on the fryer.
The griddle.
Then the griddle. Yeah, you see the five holes, right?
Yeah, boy, you had them a lot.
Yeah.
And that's just so they cook very quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, really. Imagine that. They're made fresh.
Mm.
You pull up to the drive-thru, you're not getting burgers that are sitting there for a while. They whip it up right there.
Mm-hmm.
Man, very good. All right, well, thanks to them. They have cheese sticks, too, mozzarella sticks.
They also have that thing, and I don't know what they call it, but Coca-Cola has come up with this thing where it's a machine that dispenses like 180 different flavors of soda pop. Like, you press a series of buttons.
Coke, and then you can pick 10 different flavors
of
Coke.
It's amazing. They have those at White Castle. So why wouldn't you go there? There's no reason to not go there. All right, now here's the transition of the century.
That's why I thought maybe we should take a break.
Let's take a break, and then we need to talk about some of the events that surrounded the Southwest Airlines flight from yesterday. A horrific story that could have been way, way worse. I mean, major tragedy.
Still pretty
bad. We lost one passenger, but boy, could that have been even worse. So we'll talk about that next. Stick around, Bill and Wendy, WGN.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, it's WGN Radio, and went to WashingtonPost.com to find this. The pilot's voice was calm yet focused as her plane descended with 149 people on board, and I cannot believe the composure that Captain Tammy Jo Schultz had, a former fighter pilot with the U.S. Navy, and this is what she said with her emergency call.
Yeah, we have a part of the aircraft missing, so we're going to need to slow down a bit.
Southwest 1380, speed is your discretion. Maintain at any altitude above 3,000 feet.
Okay, could you have the medical meet us there on the runway as well? We've got injured passengers.
Injured passengers, okay. And is your airplane physically on fire?
No, it's not on fire, but part of it's missing. They said there was a hole and someone went out.
I'm sorry, you said there was a hole and somebody went out? Southwest 1380, it doesn't matter. We'll work it out there. So the airport's just off to your right. Report it in flight, please.
All right. No, it's not on fire, but part of it's missing, and there's a hole and someone went out. Okay, just hearing that...
Chilling.
...would freak me out. Her composure.
Yeah, I don't understand how you can pull that off and be so cool during it. She was amazing.
The engine on Schultz's plane had, in fact, exploded on Tuesday, spraying shrapnel into the aircraft, causing a window to be blown out, leaving one woman dead, seven other people injured. Passengers pulled the woman... From my understanding, she was just sitting at her seat. That window blew out, and she, one witness said, you know, her head was obviously outside the window and her arms. Now, there's no way someone could survive that. Weren't they at this point still 30,000 feet descending to 10,000?
Yeah. Yes. That seems to be what was going on. And I was thinking about those other passengers because as all this was going on, as the engine is exploding, you have to think, if you're sitting there, realistically, this is probably the end. You know, there's so much going on and it's happening so fast. And just to have the wherewithal to come to this woman's aid, it's
to just grab her.
Yeah.
Although you think about that would be your just your natural reflex. You see someone flying out, you grab them.
You would hope.
In the midst of all the chaos, Schultz successfully completed an emergency landing at the Philadelphia International Airport, sparing the lives of 148 people aboard the Boeing 737 and averting a far worse catastrophe. What a hero she is. That you look at the engine, that thing was mangled. And the people that were interviewed said it was a very rough landing because it came in pretty quickly.
Sure.
But what an amazing job she did.
All right. This is a question that in all the reports that I saw yesterday, nobody really addressed, and I can't figure it out. I've tried to piece it together in my head. So once this woman is apparently headed towards being sucked out of the aircraft, you know, she's hanging out, her head and her arms are. So once they pull her back in, a vacuum is created there. You know, the reason she was being sucked out is there's this vacuum that's pulling her out.
An opening.
Right, right. So how did that opening remain intact without that continuing to be a problem as they landed the aircraft?
I don't know if they successfully pulled her in. I know one witness said there was definitely a lot of blood.
Yeah.
And the passenger killed was identified as Jennifer Reardon of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Her former employer, Wells Fargo, gave that information. And from my understanding, she had two small children.
Yeah.
It's just heartbreaking. She's sitting there. I saw a bunch of sketches of a plane, and it was interesting. They show there is one window near the wing, above the wing, that doesn't have glass because of this. Like this.
Yeah.
Who thinks it's going to? I mean, they're such a random thing that it hit this window.
Right. And random, I heard them discussing this on Steve's show earlier. I think Dave Ennett was the one who pointed this out, that on Southwest Airlines, it's not assigned seating. You just randomly choose a seat, you know, as your group is called. You go onto the airplane and just randomly choose one. So it makes infinitesimal odds even stranger, even harder to swallow that this woman just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I know. And yesterday when this news was breaking, we did not. They made it seem at first that she didn't have life-threatening injuries. We weren't really aware of what had transpired.
Yeah, this happened toward the end of our show yesterday.
11:30.
I think you and I, right. So details were just coming in.
Or was it 12:30 our time, maybe?
I don't know.
No, I remember doing it during your breaking in. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay. During your show.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all we heard was the flight was diverted to Philadelphia and there was an emergency landing. Then we kind of got wind of, you know, a woman or a person that was kind of out. The passenger, as I mentioned, was Jennifer Reardon. So sorry to hear that news, and it's a tragedy for her friends and family.
Sure.
It was no surprise. Tammy Jo Schultz was the pilot. She was credited with the skillful landing. Schultz's mother-in-law and friends described her as a pioneer in the aviation field, a woman who broke barriers to pursue her goals. She was among the first female fighter pilots for the U.S. Navy.
Mm.
Which is amazing, from which she graduated in 1983. And she was also among the first women to fly an FA-18 Hornet for the Navy. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
And if you hear her emergency call.
We played it.
Yeah.
So calm, so in charge.
It's shocking.
It's almost like a Sully Sullivan kind of a story that she was able to land this plane. I mean, it's a horrible tragedy that one person died. But, you know, the fact that all the others survived and they made it down safely is really true.
Tim, I was telling Wendy, and all the times I've flown, I remember twice that there have been, that I've known that it's been a female pilot. And one of the times I remember it because, as you know, when you're boarding a plane, a commercial plane, and sometimes that cockpit door is open and the pilot will be there either checking the instruments or sometimes just saying hello to you as you walk past.
Right.
It was a woman. And I remember thinking, I'm not that used to seeing a woman piloting a plane. I'm fine with it, but I'm not used to seeing it. And then there was a guy behind me getting on with his wife, and he said to his wife, oh, great, a woman flying the plane like that. Like, he wasn't kidding around. Like,
did she slap him?
Lost. No, she didn't. We'll see what happens. Well, you know, that kind of thing.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I can see.
What kind of attitude is that?
I know.
Because, listen, all right. I understand you, Bill. You saw her. You didn't think it was a bad thing, but you were a little surprised.
I just went, I'm not used to seeing this.
Right.
Good.
I'll be honest with you, 100% honest. When I heard the emergency call, I was surprised to hear that it was a woman.
Yeah.
I really was. There aren't that many women pilots. I didn't think, oh, that's why the plane crashed.
Right. Right. But what I think beyond any shadow of a doubt, what she proved was, regardless of gender, if you've got the guts to do something like this, and boy, did she. I mean, as we've all pointed out, you hear this tape of her talking about what's going on in real time as it's happening, not knowing that the future will hold, that they will land safely. And she's just calm, cool, and collected and just getting through it beautifully.
And I don't know if she knew the extent of the injuries either, because, I mean, she's busy right then and there. She's not checking what's going on in the back of the plane.
Right.
Is that the cabin? Cockpit and cabin.
Yeah.
So she was unaware of the severity of it, in my opinion, and was just being a professional. That was her job. My girlfriend Sue, her dad, Frank Mexto, just passed away, and he was a retired pilot for United Airlines, and I didn't like to fly, and my first flight was to Hawaii with Sue and her father and a bunch of girls, and I was very nervous, and he basically just said, you know, there's nothing to be afraid about. A pilot's going to do their best because they don't want to die either.
Yeah, of course.
And it does make you feel better, like, you know, wow, they're going to do everything they can.
Right.
And Tammy Jo Schultz did an amazing, heroic job.
Amazing. Just amazing. And then the follow-up to that is the story came out last night that then she personally went to each passenger upon landing to say, I'm sorry, it was such an awful flight. Is everything okay? Are you okay? You know, that's above and beyond the call of duty. That's amazing.
That's why women rock.
Right. Right.
A man would have done it too, I guess.
She has nerves of steel and great compassion for people. You can't. That's two great attributes. Yeah. They're amazing.
Hi, Jody.
Hi. On March 8th, which I think is International Women's Day, my husband and I flew United to Mexico, and we had a female pilot whose co-pilot was her husband.
That's awesome.
Wow. That's like a sitcom.
I thought it was unbelievably awesome. And the fact that it was the day of for women or something, it was just awesome.
So did they point that out? They must have pointed that out to everybody somehow on the plane, right?
Well, when they announced, you know, when she came on and she said, you know, I am the pilot, my name is so-and-so and I'm the pilot, and my husband so-and-so and so-and-so is my co-pilot today.
And our kids will be the flight attendants, so be nice to them.
It's a family affair.
Now, see, I'm curious as to why an airline would allow that to happen. Shouldn't they be in two separate planes in case something does happen?
They have a fight. What if they had a fight, a marital spat on the airline?
That's something that could happen. But in case of an accident, you know, both parents would be gone.
I thought of that.
That's interesting.
She wouldn't be afraid if they got lost to stop and ask directions somewhere. A guy would just go.
Who do you ask? A blue jay?
Yes. A blue jay.
The Jetsons flying by.
Right.
Jody, thank you so much. And everybody was cool with that on board, correct? Did anybody go, a woman driver?
No. We all laughed and applauded. And when we walked out, they were both standing by the cockpit. And it was just, you know, it was just fun.
That's awesome. Thank you, Jody. I appreciate your call.
You're welcome.
Bill does, too.
I do, too.
And let's talk to Joel. I just want you to know I edited myself.
Did you? Why?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, it's called the cockpit, but if there's a...
Joel, hi. How are you?
I'm okay. How's Wendy doing?
We're all worried. Everyone's worried.
Thanks for saving me,
sure,
pal. All right. So what's your story, Joel?
Well, with the cabin pressure... it gets pressurized in the plane before they take off. That's why your ears pop.
Yeah.
And then once you get up to, you know, 30,000 feet or whatever, and if there's a hole in there, everything gets sucked out or until the pressure equalizes.
But Bill's question was, if the woman was kind of being sucked out of the window and they were able to pull her back to her seat and in the cabin, did they just put like a seat cushion up against that? Wouldn't that hole still be trying to suck something out?
Well, probably by then everything was equalized. The pressure was equalized.
So as the plane descends, as the plane gets lower, you've got less of that sort of a vacuum effect, right?
That's my understanding, yes.
All right.
Still scary, man.
Are you
it's kind of like the same concept of what, remember when you were a kid with the hard-boiled egg and the milk bottle?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
No, I never played this trick. What is it?
Explain it to Wendy, Joel.
Well, if you get a hard-boiled egg, this was back when they had the milk bottles.
Yeah.
And the hard-boiled egg was bigger after you peel it. Yeah, the hard-boiled egg is bigger than the opening on the top of the
glass bottle.
Yeah, if you drop the match in there and then put the egg on top, it would suck it in after a couple minutes.
What?
Yeah.
I got to try this.
A science fair project for kids in school.
You're aware of this?
I remember seeing a kid do it, yeah.
I got to try this, Joel.
You probably never paid attention in science class, did you?
No, we were too busy cutting up, dissecting fetal pigs and frogs.
Mm.
I like this milk bottle thing.
Well, how do you know all this about the are you affiliated with an airline at some point?
I kind of stayed at a Red Roof Inn last night.
Oh,
I know this.
All right.
Joel,
that'll work.
Thank you so much. You
bye.
Goof.
It's almost like being an airline pilot.
Yeah, I guess. Well, we both wanted to salute Tammy Jo Schultz. I will admit I was a little shocked I heard a female's voice given that call, but the calm, cool, collected Tammy Jo Schultz, really, truly a hero.
Outstanding. It really is. All right, well, we'll talk to Steve Bertrand next. Wendy and I are headed toward the stream. We'd love for you to join us. It's always fun on the stream, the bonus hour, or stay right here and find out what's on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.